You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives.
As young teachers and scholars in the field, we have a lot on our minds. We want to enact social justice in our classrooms. We try to do this by considering diverse student bodies, incorporating multimodality into our classrooms, developing equitable assessment, and so much more. What about participation in democracy? Even if we value participation and democracy in our classes, what do these concepts look like in reality? And what about the pesky problem of authority? What about the unequal power relations between teacher and student? These are the questions that Naeem Anatullah considers as an educator. As professor and chair of the Department of Politics at Ithaca College, Dr. Anatullah's research focuses on the politics of pedagogy, the global political economy, and development studies. He builds upon Ira Shore and Paulo Freire's work in coming to practice something that he calls Socratic collective improvisation. Drawing on the theory of Lacan, he works toward spaces of encounter in the classroom and ties his work in the classroom to broader concepts of imperialism. In this interview, I speak with Naeem in his home in Ithaca, New York. I ask him to begin by telling us how he got started.
I was an undergraduate at Michigan State University, and I was basically interested in development economics, and I actually took a master's degree from Michigan State in development economics as well. So I was hoping to get a job with the World Bank at some point, and I put out an application after my master's, and they were very interested, or so they said. And so they said, get a PhD and apply again. So I took a year off between my master's and my PhD, and then I went to the University of Denver with the idea that I was going to take my master's thesis and turn it into a PhD, reapply to the World Bank, and have my international career. But what happened instead was that I couldn't really make any sense out of development economics, and so I went into the history of economic thought, mm-hmm. and more or less became fascinated by Adam Smith and by Karl Marx and by Hegel, and my mentors were studying those people as well. And so as the process of the dissertation writing proceeded, I realized that I was not going to end up at the World Bank after all, and that I was probably going to end up trying to stay on some kind of campus for the rest of my life. So that's I didn't get an economics PhD, I got a PhD in international studies, and that allowed me to become a professor of international studies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I wanted to talk about your article, Wading in the Deep, Supporting Emergent Anarchies. In it, you discuss how you started out as an anxious teacher and how you overplanned a lot in the beginning years. I find I do that a lot these days as a teacher starting out. And you soon realized that you had to step back. I wanted you to talk about how you started out and then how you came to structure your classes.
It wasn't so much that I overplanned in my first few years. It was that I did what I was expected of me. I was teaching three courses at the University of Colorado at Boulder and lecturing. And lecturing was what I had seen everybody do that taught me. And I would come home from class and I would prepare my lectures. And it was 80 hours a week, 70, 80 hours a week, and lots of lectures. And I was enjoying it. I was actually quite successful as a lecturer. I had large classes, and even the small classes, which were a little bit more participatory, but still there was a large dose of lecture by me. And it all went really well, actually. The students liked my teaching. I liked my students. But what I began to realize was that they weren't interested in what I was trying to teach. And they could fake it, but deep down inside, what I wanted them to understand was the global political economy and the inequalities in the global political economy, and they really weren't interested in that. And so the whole project of getting to an alternative pedagogy started out by my realization that I wasn't actually getting through to my students. And eventually, as I started to experiment, my first tenure track job was at Syracuse University, and I started lots of experimentation. What I tried to do was I tried to think to myself, okay, if they're not going to meet me at my specialization, I'm going to have to try and meet them where they are. And so the sort of the principle became learn about the students, learn about where they are, and try and meet them where they are, try to figure out what their needs are and try to address their needs. Simultaneously, of course, I was interested in meeting my own needs, which was to talk about the kinds of issues of global political economy and inequality and injustice that were important to me. So it became an issue of encounter instead of a lecture. It became an issue of encounter, and the whole project became how can I set up these encounters with my students so that both parties bring something, both parties take something away.
You talk about participation. There's something I was reading that a lot of times people talk about democracy. Tell me if I'm wrong, but yeah. People talk about democracy and citizenship and participation. Yeah. But when it comes to the classroom, they're not ready to actually do participation and deal with the effects or consequences of participation. And I wanted you to talk about that and how you came to practice these ideas in your classroom.
From the beginning, thought about my responsibilities in the classroom. And so one of the first questions I asked myself was, what responsibilities do I have to the person who is politically the opposite of me in the classroom? And I decided early on that I had some responsibilities, pedagogical responsibilities to those students. So as I started thinking in this way, the issues of power within the classroom surfaced. And I had noticed also in my own teachers that they had a different kind of relation. Different professors had a different approach to how they thought of power within the classroom. But none of this is explicit in any of the professors that I met, and none of it was explicit in any of the TAs that I associated with. And so there's almost, I still continue to believe that there's a taboo. It is a taboo on bringing the topics that we theorize, justice, inequality, into the classroom. So the classroom is almost a taboo space. So the sort of the unwritten rule is that we can talk about these things in the classroom, but we can't talk about how those things play out inside the classroom. And that's actually a pretty vicious taboo. Breaking it upsets a lot of people. And I started to break that taboo a little bit, and it did get me into a lot of trouble, but it also helped me to understand how to formulate the classroom space as an encounter, not necessarily something that's equal between the professor and the student, because I've learned the hard way that that's probably not possible, but by experiment, trying to understand what is in fact possible. If the professor cannot get rid of his or her power in the room and still wants to think about inequality and justice and power in the classroom, what can be done? And so every course became a quasi-experiment designed to answer that particular question.
You said that you got into a bit of trouble. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, yes. When I experimented and I did not succeed, the students were not happy. So a lot of the unhappiness came from my students. But most of the unhappiness came from my colleagues who could see that I was doing all kinds of experimental work in the classroom and was often effective in the way that the students would kind of elevate themselves into this metaspace that we had created. And they then would take those experiences into other classrooms and demand similar kinds of experiences from other professors. And of course, that did not work. So I had a different kind of writing approach, which they took into other courses. I had a different kind of conversational approach. Everything about the way I was doing things was quite different and provocative. And in fact, I was censured to some degree, both by students, but mainly by colleagues and my chair. And so, but I guess the more important thing to say is that if you don't start the process of, I keep saying experiment, but it's actually, that's too neutral a word. if you don't start to theorize your pedagogy from the beginning, by the time you get tenure, it's too late.
So I want you to give us some of the specifics about what exactly are you doing in your courses.
What I do, let me work backwards. I'll tell you what I do now, and then I'll tell you what I used to do then. What I do now is much more a Socratic collective improvisation. And I'm much more interventionary now in the classroom. I expect the students to come prepared, having read, but there's no lecture. And so after a few sort of logistical preliminaries, I go straight to the floor is open, and then we just discuss. And whatever people say, I will try to, from their point of view, it's an interrogation. But from my point of view, is I'm trying to get them to articulate their bodily presence in the room, their bodies feeling something about the reading or about something that somebody has said. And I will try to bring that out in very neutral terms and then ask the student, is this what you're trying to say? Is this what you mean? So there's a way in which it becomes a very public space. They bring their sort of emotions into this public space. And then we have this, it's not a war of all against all, but it's sometimes chaotic and sometimes always sort of anarchic because almost anything can happen. And you get, sometimes you get crying students, sometimes you get screaming students, sometimes nothing happens if nobody's prepared. So it's very much in the moment, but so that's what I'm doing now, that collective improvisation. What I was doing then back at Syracuse was similar, except for that I barely intervened at all. So I did a lot of listening. I did a lot of letting students say what they needed to say and letting them be angry with each other if necessary. And so there was I was on the edges, sort of participating, but sort of not. And right. Well, what I was doing in the classroom was, on the one hand, nothing much from the point of view of somebody who lectures, or even from the point of view of somebody who manages the discussion quite closely. But from another point of view, it was a way of treating the silences in the room as fertile. And it allowed students to really say things when they got the hang of it, that they could actually say anything that they wanted. There was something at stake in the room. And so they would, in fact, they would do the reading even more closely because they knew that once they got into the room, there was much at stake in their own voice. And so what I was doing was sort of, we talked before about theorizing the pedagogy, theorizing power politics in the room and justice, inequality, and sort of letting those come out from the relationships that the students had with each other and with the material, and then pointing to them at some point, hey, look, maybe this is what's happening. So it's very much, in some ways, drama, a lot of drama in the room. And not much progress being made vis-a-vis a syllabus that's temporally oriented. You know, week one we do this, week two we do this, and we build it to this 14th week in which everything comes together. None of that was going on. It was more very much, let's see what happens if we get together, if we do the reading and we discuss, let's see what happens. I still, like as I said, I do a collective improvisation, Socratic dialogues, collective improvisation, but with a Lacanian bent. So one of the things I've learned is that what students are really learning is to find out the desire of the professor and replicate it. And so my technique is that I don't let them see that. It's a very rare student who's actually able to penetrate my shields and see what my biases are. So they don't actually get to see what my positions are, and although it's pretty easy, all they have to do is read my stuff. But you know, they're otherwise busy, so they end up being some of them very frustrated with not. They come to my office and they say, "I don't know what you want. Tell me what you want." And I say, "It's that you don't know what I want is my goal, and what I want you to want is what you want." And so that the anarchy, the politicized space, the Lacanian mask, the whole, you know, and one of the most important things that happens in in my classrooms is that we do not quarantine emotion from thought. So here, dialectically, I will always say to them, look, a thought is just expressed emotion. Emotion is just thought that hasn't been expressed yet. And so, as I said, anything can happen. People get upset. People cry. People laugh. They yell. They scream. They walk out. They slam their books. one of the costs of going this route is that it's a very lonely route. And it is only the result of my mini sabbatical last fall, where I read a few books, Reichert's Acts of Enjoyment, and another book called Changing the Subject in English Class. And mining those citations, I found that there's actually a community in rhetoric that is all about writing and teaching and Lacan. And for the longest time, I thought I was out there beyond Pluto by myself. But in fact, there's a whole little galaxy of us. I don't know them yet, except for their work. So the cost of this kind of risk-taking is that you end up being very alone, sometimes marginalized, not necessarily rewarded, at least institutionally not rewarded.
So even though you don't share your views maybe directly in the classroom, they can't penetrate that, you're still a man of color. Mm. And I was wondering how your identity, how you appear, your body appears to students, and how that affects their reading of what
Good
exactly
question.
You're doing.
Well, I'm brown. I'm brown. I'm originally from Pakistan. But you'll notice that my accent is very American. So they give me a pass. I sometimes change my accent and make them realize that, in fact, you know, they're hearing me in a particular way. The way I appear in the classroom is something that I try to keep them confused about. So one day I will wear a tie, and a second day I will wear a kurta, a third day I will wear Indonesian batik. So I play with them a lot in ways that they don't really grasp. I'm trying to confuse them about my identity, and sometimes they forget that I'm brown, and then sometimes I'll remind them, but that's rare. It's a rare semester when I'll ask this question, and I'll say, "Do you think they'll talk about my teaching on the last day of class?" And they'll say, "You know, X, Y, and Z." And I'll say, "Do you think that the pedagogy that you've been exposed to, do you think that's an accident? Do you think it's an accident that it has some? Does it have anything to do with my color?"
I want you to talk about the function of writing in your classes, and why is writing integral?
Back in Colorado, when I saw that students had different skills in writing, the first question that occurred to me was, what is my responsibility in this situation? And I guess, like a fool, I thought, again, it is my responsibility to help them understand what writing can be like. And once I got out of the very big classes, well, actually even Syracuse, I had big classes, but they had to do Blue Book. I've never done multiple choice or anything like that. It's always been essays. So as far back as I can remember, 100% of the grade in all of my classes is based in writing, and I tell them that right in front. And I also tell them, I'm not going to farm you out to the writing shop. If you're a poor writer, I'm the one that is going to be the one that's going to deal with your writing. We'll do it together. So, I mean, it is an old adage that I believe, and it's not radical, which is, if you can't write it, you don't know it. And, or more important, let's go back to dialectics for a second, that writing is that process which unfolds what is inside to what is outside. So that's another adage. But I've gone even further than that. I've now gone to sort of the more Lacanian mode, where one has to strike a balance between control and absence of control in the writing. And when you have that balance, then what happens is that the writing writes back. And that's the crucial moment. Too much control and you don't learn anything from the writing process. Too little control and again, the writing will not write back to you. Striking that balance between form and improvisation, between superego and the unconscious, if you've got that balance and you've got that technique, then what happens is that the writing actually writes back. And that's what I actually practice with my students. The way I read their papers is that there's always two elements. There's the element of dominance and control and imperialism that their pen and they're putting on the piece. But then there's always something that's elusive in the writing that's actually speaking back to them. And I always go for that. I always try and find that space in the writing where there's this counter theme that's talking back. And then the project becomes to get the student to see that there are, in fact, these two themes that are in conflict, at least two, many more probably, at least two themes in conflict with each other. And how does the student account for the fact that there are these two themes? And then once that project is underway, it sort of runs away with itself. There's very little that I have to do content-wise. It's mostly always about form.
In writing classes, there are some who, for example, like Ira Shore, who do work that is very maybe anarchic in the classroom, kind of what you're doing, but maybe with a different end or with a different theoretical approach to why he is doing it. He talks about helping students to become citizens, to be earth stewards, or to become critical thinkers in the classroom. And the way he does that is through a dialogue in classroom. But one of the connections that I saw you doing in your work was saying that what you do in the classroom and how you interact with your students is supposed to maybe challenge the ways in which authority works in your classroom, but then also thinking about something that's global in terms of the United States and how the United States interacts with the rest of the world. So these were kind of really interesting ideas to me. I wanted you to just talk a little bit more about that.
Ira Shore is a big inspiration. The book that I know of his is the one that's a dialogue between he and Paulo Freire. So let me go to Paulo Freire for a second. I reread Paulo Freire in my last mini sabbatical, and I couldn't find myself in him anymore. And it's because I think that there's an activist progressive agenda in there that I no longer believe in. And maybe this speaks to what you wanted me to speak about. Let's go back to the Lacanian stance again. I think now it's my job, as I think I've been trying to say, is merely to get them to be self-conscious of their own contradictions, if even that is possible, and not allow them to see my desire. And I think once you bring in an activist impulse into the classroom, the whole pedagogy folds. There's a symmetrical pathology in the room where they're very keen to figure out what the professor's desire is. The professor's very keen to impart that desire to the students, and it just, it's hand in glove, it works too well. And so if now to bring it back to the macro, I mean, if remember I said that one of the things I was interested in doing was thinking about the space in the classroom as an encounter. And so it turns out that my research and theoretical work is also about encounter. And so there's an obvious way in which I'm shifting back and forth between thinking about the conquistadors and the Native Americans or the United States and its current foreign policy. How, in essence, those are pedagogical projects. And those pedagogical projects are very much dominated by idealist positions, not realist positions, not we're in it for the gold and the money and all that. In fact, the real agenda is always a pedagogical agenda. You know, we can make them into Christians, we can make them free, we can make them into democracies. And for me, that's the much more dangerous thing. And so that's sort of the anti-encounter. So in a way, the experiments in the classroom are designed for me to figure out whether there's a way that my encounter, I'm the powerful one, they're the students there that don't have the grade and the power. Is there an opportunity there for an encounter that is meaningful and utopic in some sense, which we can then also think about as something that could happen in the macro world? Or the other way around, are there encounters that have actually happened in exchanges between various cultures in different parts of history, which give us insight into how we might engage with our students, in which there's a pedagogy that's happening, but it's not a lecture. It's not an idealist imposition. It's not imperialism, even with good intentions.
You were talking about in the article, the teaching impulse. This is kind of coming up now in what you were talking about right now.
Yes.
We are circling, and that's okay.
We're circling around your needs. That's how it should be.
So I wanted you to talk a little bit about the teaching impulse and how this is relating to what I think that kind of grounds it for people who might not exactly be familiar with the theory that you're referring to.
The teaching impulse, I think, originates with a prior assumption, which I've written about in an article, the title of which is, Why do some people think they know what's best for others? And the answer to that question in that article is, they think they know what's best for others because they have some kind of knowledge that others don't have and from which others can benefit. And so on the one hand, I give that a name. I call it exclusive knowledge. The claim to exclusive knowledge is the impulse to teach. And on the one hand, it has a positive side because all of us have some kind of exclusive insight. And it is a responsibility for us to share that with others. On the other hand, it is almost always the case that a claim to exclusive knowledge leads you not into encounters, but into the pedagogical imposition, the impulse to teach. So my take on this is that the most dangerous thing that we have as human beings is this impulse to teach. That imperialism is not necessarily, especially modern imperialism, Western imperialism, is not just born from the need for oil, the need for gold. It's born from the need to feel as if one's exclusive knowledge is in fact exclusive. And the way that you prove that is you find the lack in the other, then you fill that lack with your exclusive knowledge, and then they become replicas of you, and once they become replicas of you, then you feel satisfied that in fact you were right all along, that your exclusive knowledge was in fact exclusive, and that you are some kind of special human being. The encounter impulse is the opposite of that. It comes instead from a humility. Actually, it comes from the same place, this lack. There's a lack in the imperialist, which on the one hand, the imperialist has to fill by making replicas of himself. On the other hand, that lack also projects a kind of emptiness which the other can see, the other can feel. And so there's a double project going on in the teacher, in the imperialist. On the one hand, this incredible projection of exclusivity. On the other hand, this incredible projection of this lack, this absence of love, this absence of being in the world with others. So those things are going on at the same time. And I see the United States in this particular way, but I also see my own role in the classroom in this same way.
And that was Dr. Naeem Anatolla, professor and chair of the Department of Politics at Ithaca College. And I'm Tamara Ishaq.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Ishaq, and Seth Davis.